Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulis. This is an amazing podcast, really the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulis.
So welcome to episode, I think, 14 of the Security Perimeter Podcast. Today's guest is extra special. His name is Alan Burson. He was the Undersecretary of State for Homeland Security under the Obama administration. He really has some pretty impressive and interesting ideas about how borders can be made more safe, that don't necessarily involve putting up a really big, beautiful wall with some nice doors every once in a while. But before we get to the interview, just some administrative things that I want to deal with. I'm going to be away for about a week and a half on a trip to Canada, and it's going to take a while for me to get the next episode up. Sorry, this episode actually took a bit of a long time to put together because I was away in Baltimore last week. I suspect that it's going to take about a couple more weeks to get the next episode up. But you have a lot to enjoy and, please, a lot to share and like with this particular episode with Mr. Alan Burson. So I hope... I'll say it again. I hope you're going to share it. I hope you're going to like it. And email us at perimeterpodcast@gmail.com. I'll say it again, perimeterpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to make any kind of suggestions on how to make the podcast better or the guests, future guests that you'd like to have on the show, it'll help me a lot. So... please give me some input on what you think about the podcast so far. Okay, well, on to the interview with Alan Burson. Bye bye now.
Hello, this is David Wilkinson, UCLA political science professor, and you are listening to the Security Perimeter Podcast, the gold standard of Perimeter Podcast.
And you know what? That'll be in the podcast because I like starting a podcast in a strange way. Okay. As opposed to, hello, this is... Okay. So I'm going to do that. Hello, Alan Burson. Thank you very much for being with us at the Security Perimeter Podcast. Let me introduce Alan very briefly before we get into this discussion. Alan is my new best friend. He used to work for the Obama administration. He was undersecretary. Alan was the Undersecretary of State for International Affairs, right? At Homeland Security.
And the Borders Secretary are. for International Affairs and Policy.
And Policy.
I was in the Clinton administration, the so-called Borders Czar, and then came back in the beginning of the Obama administration in the same role.
Okay. So the Borders Czar is a pretty important position in the U.S. You may not have heard of it, you listeners out there, but I bet you've heard of things like the Drug Czar or the Finance Czar or the Economic Czar. Well, the Borders Czar is basically responsible for U.S. borders, which is... you know, kind of important nowadays. And Alan also was in charge of pretty much everybody in ICE and everybody else who had something to do with borders and migration. Is that right?
So there was a distinction, Socket, between the Borders Czar, which was really a coordinating role.
Right.
And the role was created, the Southwest Border Representative, and then the Border Representative for Secretary Napolitano was created to coordinate, because in fact all of these agencies had very specific duties and roles and responsibilities on the border, right. But there was very little coordination among and between them.
Right.
So the concept of creating these border representative was to provide this element of interagency coordination.
And then
that's to be distinguished, though, from the operational role that I had when I was appointed by President Obama as the Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, which is, in fact, the largest operational law enforcement agency in the country.
67,000, right?
Just over 60,000 now, with responsibilities to both police the areas between the ports of entry, airports, mm-hmm. seaports, and land ports, and also to administer those ports with Customs and Border Protection officers. There are 327 ports of entry into the United States, land ports, seaports, airports, and that's under CBP, Customs and Border Protection,
right?
But also the Border Patrol. 22,000 Border Patrol agents that are responsible for patrolling the areas between the ports of entry, for the most part on the southwest border, although there are 2,000 agents now in your previous homeland of Canada, on the border in Canada.
Don't say that too loud because they might take away my passport or something.
That doesn't happen here.
Yeah, I know. No, not the Mexicans, the Canadians. Okay, so that's about as important a job as you could get as far as borders is concerned, right? So, Alan, I saw you give a talk about a month, actually more like 2 months ago, 3 months ago, right, when you came to the university, and I wholeheartedly agreed with everything that you had to say about how to protect borders. In fact, the ideas that you put forth were very consistent with this idea of smart border technology, you know, separating safe travelers from unknowns and then only working with unknowns. But could you give us an idea of how you view a safe border? I mean, what's your opinion in terms of how to create a safe border, particularly in the context of Mexico and the United States?
The starting point for that discussion, yeah. Saki, is that there is no absolute security. In fact, the only absolute security or serenity that I know of is in the graveyard. So that, in fact, in the context of any human activity, there will be risks. And that's why the governing theory of action on border security is risk management.
Right.
Because, in fact, you cannot eliminate all risk because of the number of people and the number of things that cross borders daily. So a safe and secure border is one that is considered by its people. That is to say, the people in the area, and more generally, to decide what is safe and secure sufficiently.
Are you talking about, you know, citizens living in the towns, or
well, it's
or
a broader. Well, it's both. Yeah. So you have those who los fronterizos, the borderlanders,
right.
who live in the border area, and they have a judgment as to whether or not the border line is safe in terms of typical crime rates, levels of violence, degrees of illegal activity.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to a judgment. I will say, interestingly enough, in the last generation, 4 of the 10 safest cities, judged by traditional FBI crime statistics,
right.
have been in the on the U.S.-Mexican border.
El Paso, right?
El Paso for one, San Diego for another, Phoenix, Austin, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
These are cities that are free from the kinds of crime rates.
So four out of the 7 top safe cities.
Four
out of 10 top safe cities in the U.S. are along the Mexican border.
Correct.
Okay, sorry.
But the other point, though, is how borders are perceived in the body politic. And that can be more or less inconsistent or consistent with the facts on the ground. I think we have a situation now in which the border is... has been portrayed in ways that are inconsistent with those who live on the border Mm-hmm. And those who work on the border know that the border is not has not been out of control. I, as a fronterizo que vive in San Diego, Tijuana, I know when I began work on the border in the early 90s in 1993, that in fact the border was out of control. That that people were being there were more than a million people a year being arrested within a 3-mile stretch of the Pacific Ocean moving eastward. The fact of the matter is that this last year we've seen the lowest number of apprehensions on the U.S.-Mexican border in a generation. And the majority of those who have been apprehended are not Mexican. They're Central American. And that reflects both increased border security in classical terms, that is, surveillance and stopping the movement of unlawful cargo and unlawful irregular migrants, but it also reflects the extent to which the Mexican economy is completely changed over the last generation, and that it is no accident that a million people a year were being arrested in San Diego, Tijuana, in 1993. In 1994, the North American Free Trade Association, a free trade agreement was signed, the Tratado de Libre Comercio. Right. And if you fast forward to last year, the number of Mexicans arrested was under 200,000. And there's been an 88% decrease in the number of Mexicans being detained for immigration purposes.
But doesn't that have more to do with the 2008 crisis? The U.S. hasn't quite recovered from that, right?
That's actually not the case. In fact, manufacturing levels in the United States are back to where they were. Perhaps we'll get into this subject later. The difficulty is that while the manufacturing levels are at the same as they were in 2007, 2008, it's being done with 60% of the industrial jobs that were the case 8 years ago, 9 years ago. But the fact is the Pew Foundation has reported that there's a negative inflow of Mexicans into the United States is due to the growth in the Mexican economy. As much as it is to the border security that makes it much more difficult to cross into the United States. The large influx of Central Americans, for the most part of families and unaccompanied minors, actually has a lot to do with the same push factors that pushed Mexicans across the border for 70 years, but is no longer doing so. But there are other factors that we can get into during the course of the discussion.
Well, let me ask you this. It's my fault we took us off what I wanted to get on, which was, I suspect you don't think problems along the border can be solved with a wall. Very few. There are other better possibilities. Smart border technology, for example.
So there are two elements to this. First, we have to recognize that in a global world, the flows north and south across our border are more important than the line that stretches from east to west. For most of U.S.-Mexican history, la línea tenía la importancia. But actually, the border line is less important than what's happening north and south of that line.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, I think that screening that takes place in advance of coming up to the border, and in fact, very sophisticated algorithms that search big data, are much better guides to managing the risk on the border. You know, the
separating safe travelers from unknown travelers, giving those safe travelers identification to have easier access into the United States.
Precisely.
And vice versa.
Precisely. Those are all methods of modern border management that actually enhance security. The fact of a wall has become a political metaphor, but indeed, and I presided over a fair amount of the placing of barriers in places on the U.S.-Mexican border. So there's about 700 miles of the 1,900 miles of border that have barriers of some sort. But for the most part, the high walls, the ones that the triple wall in San Diego, was a reaction to the fact that you wanted to move the traffic flows away from the urban areas in El Paso, Juarez, San Diego, Tijuana, so that people would then cross over and get onto the mass transit or the transit that could take them to Los Angeles or take them to Houston or elsewhere into the interior of the United States. So the point of the walls or the fences was to actually divert, tactically create a more acceptable surveillance and detection technique. The notion and most of the barriers, most of the so-called fences, are actually Normandy type barriers that are placed in desert areas or in hilly areas that are intended to keep vehicles from taking large numbers of migrants or people or goods illicit or illicit across in a smuggling fashion. So the bottom line, I think, on the wall that's gotten so much attention is that walls, as Secretary Kelly, our new Homeland Security Secretary, has acknowledged, without deployment, without surveillance, without the whole infrastructure of border protection, really don't solve the problem at end. Because, as Janet Napolitano so artfully pointed out, if you build a 50-foot wall, someone will come along with a 51-foot ladder. That, together with the diversion of traffic out into the maritime areas in the Gulf of Mexico or in the Pacific Ocean, or the tunneling under walls, all of these are obstacles that make a wall questionable from a cost
benefit. It's a layered defense system, isn't it? I mean, at the point and beyond the point, it isn't simply the existence of a wall that would solve the problem. Well, okay, I berate my Mexican colleagues or Mexican friends in the Army and the Navy and so forth and the government. And one thing that I tell them is, you know, the border, don't be surprised that the body politic of the United States all of a sudden it's picked the border as a problem. This has been a problem for 40 years.
Even
more so, yeah. I'm thinking back when the war against drug was declared in the mid-70s with Nixon, right? So this is nothing new. And I think we had an opportunity after 2001 with the signing of the Smart Border Agreement to really make a lot of progress on the border. Just like the Canadians and the Americans did on the northern border. And the kinds of things that the Canadians and the Americans implemented, now granted, I mean, it's a completely different relationship. There's a long history.
I would argue with that, Saki.
How much work has been done in terms of implementing the post-9/11 border agreement?
A substantial amount of work has been done. That is one of the facts on the ground that I think remain to be discovered by some of my colleagues in the new administration. Our relationship with Mexico, in its own way, is as robust and in some respects more robust than the relationship with the Canadian police and Canadian Border Services Agency. The relationship with CBSA, the border agency, CBP's sister agency, Canada Border Services Agency, and with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, is superb. It's at a very high level, but I would argue that you will find similar relationships now existing between Customs and Border Protection, Homeland Security investigations, enforcement removal operations, and agencies such as INAME, the Mexican Immigration Institute, relationship with Policía Federal is very close. The relationship with SAT, with the customs authorities, these are relationships that have taken deep root in the last 10 years, And
particularly under Calderon, and I suspect
and
to
Peña
some extent,
and, no, and President Peña Nieto as well.
Yeah.
In fact, in many ways, the post-Mérida relationship in 2006 set the stage. And you'll recall that when President Peña Nieto was elected, there were many Americans and Mexicans who thought that the PRI would actually change the nature of the security relationship, and that has not turned out to be the case. In fact, to some extent,
because I have friends in the Navy, for example, that tell me that immediately after the election of Peña Nieto, there was a kind of freezing in the relationship.
There was a period for a year.
Yeah.
But listen.
But then they kind of adapted to the new system, and the Navy said, what the heck, we're going to do it anyways.
Well, right? Precisely. But this was, listen, whenever you get a change of government of the kind that we've recently had in the United States, there is a period of adaptation, a period of a learning period in which the new administration, with a wholly new set of cast of characters in important positions, come in with preconceptions, come in with notions, and then after a while, some of those are confirmed, but most of them are discarded because they turn out to be inconsistent with the facts on the ground.
Reality on the ground.
So I would take issue with the fact, our relationship with Mexico in the security sense is not as equally important and effective as our relationship with Canada. It is, with the exception of, we talked earlier before the podcast,
NORAD
of NORAD.
And NATO as well.
And NATO. But that's in a more classical national security military sense. In a police law enforcement sense, in a travel facilitation sense, relationships are remarkably similar. In fact, when you think about what takes place in continental security now among the three countries, it's actually, again, quite remarkable. Mexico, for example, shares all of its airline data, PNR data, passenger name record data, advanced passenger information system data, all of the people entering Mexico through the air and sea are actually, they are checked against American
watch lists
and databases to identify high risk persons from both a counter-terror perspective and also a criminal perspective.
Just to make something clear, though, for the listeners who don't know this, this includes also flights, for example, that are going straight from Mexico City to Montreal with Aeroméxico, just literally flying over the U.S. The U.S. and Mexico and Canada have actually begun sharing
but this is
there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
This is a very important security relationship, and it's done in a way that's consistent with maintaining privacy and respecting human rights. This is not data that's made widely available. And when there is a match or an alert, there's close communication between law enforcement agencies in Mexico, the United States, and United States and Canada, that actually processes the alert. U.S. Officers from Customs and Border Protection are present in Mexican airports in Benito Juarez, working with INAME and with Policía Federal to deal with flights that are last point of departure flights to the U.S. And there is regular cooperation in terms of securing the flow of people to the United States from Mexico. Mexico has members of SAT, of aduaneros, who are actually pre-clearing air cargo into Mexico from the airport in Laredo, Texas, pre-clearing pre-clearing the cargo. There are Mexican aduaneros, members of SAT, who work in the National Targeting Center in the United States, screening cargo on behalf of both countries. This is a security relationship that is both broad and deep.
Right.
And we haven't even touched on the work that we've done together in terms of migration management.
Yeah.
And I'm happy
to talk
turn
a little
to
bit about that. But before you do that, in the case of the Canada-U.S. border, there's something called Integrated Border Enforcement Teams, the IBETs, where it's joint patrols along the border. Do you think
You know, so there are no joint patrols. That was something that was not done. What IBETS is a joint intelligence function in which you have RCMP and CBP officers co-located with the idea that they will be sharing information. Truth be told, as effective as those arrangements can be, they can be improved. And I don't think there's their senior leaders in either Canada or Mexico, the Border Patrol, the RCMP, that don't think they can be improved. But this is not a...
But I've seen New York State Police cars in the Canadian side of Niagara.
This is state. Yeah. These are state operations. Ontario police officers cooperating, New York State cooperating.
They cross the border regularly.
This is not the federal to federal.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Relationship. In fact, local relationships always count.
Right.
And they get built up, quite frankly, regardless of the nature of
what's
the
happening
federal
in Ottawa or Washington. Correct. Right. Which is something that's significant in the Mexico-U.S. border, in the sense that the times that I've been there, both Mexican and U.S. authorities have told me that you don't know the border. This is like practically a different country. You know, there's the United States, there's Mexico, and then there's the border.
Se llama el tercer país.
Right, el tercer país. And it's quite surprising, at least the last time that I went to the border, that you don't only hear this from Mexicans, but you also actually hear it from certain American authorities as well.
So 15 million of us who live on the border, los fronterizos, the borderlanders, actually feel that way. Yeah. For me, before and after 9/11, Tijuana is just the other side of town. I have many friends. I have restaurants I prefer in Tijuana. I have there are cultural attractions. So the idea of a wall doesn't mean that there won't be crossings.
No.
Of course there are. In fact, we have the triple wall in San Tijuana now, but that doesn't mean people aren't crossing regularly. They are. And in fact, with the use of the Century Lane...
Remember, he did say that there's going to be a wall, but there's going to be beautiful doors in that wall as well. So
I am not... Unlike some, I don't take.
I put you on the spot.
I don't
there,
take right. the opportunity to knock our new president.
Yes,
I think that time will tell, and as I say, people who underestimate his intelligence have suffered in the last year and a half in the United States, and I really urge everyone to watch and wait. I think the travel ban gave people an impression that there was not the ability to learn, and yet I think the president, having reacted to the court decision by saying in effect
I give up.
He is ordered the redrafting of it, indicates that I think a healthy wait and see. That's not to mean that people shouldn't be vigilant
right.
in protection of their rights and in protection of social values that seem to be less important to this administration. But what we don't need right now, and I'll reserve my judgment as to what might be needed, in my view, downstream, but what we don't need now is further division. The most corrosive impact on security and, frankly, on many other things going on, both in Mexico and in the United States, is this sharp division that we have among our people with regard to issues. And that is something we should all have an interest in reducing, so that we can see dialogue and debate restored to the proper place that they have in a democracy.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about...
Thank you for letting me get on my soapbox. But I meant every word of it.
Of course you did, and I believe it. I do. Tell us a little bit about what Americans who live along the border think about some of the proposals, and I said many of them, and this crosses party lines, don't feel particularly strong about some of the policies that are being talked about, right?
So the
because it's like el tercer país or
And that's always been the case that we've always, those of us who've lived on the border have had, we've shared foods, we've shared news, we've shared neighborhoods, we've shared music, we've shared language. So yes, there is a something to the el tercer país, but in a global world, actually, this is spread beyond the border.
Yeah.
You know, we have to start looking, Sake, at the fact that the 10 border states, 6 in Mexico, 4 in the United States, together have the fourth largest economy in the world.
It's huge.
The kinds of relationships that have been built up, not only socially and culturally, but that exist in terms of shared production platforms, and the extent to which we are increasingly an integrated economic unit, you know, these are facts that are not going to be undone so easily. So, you know, I think many of us who live on the border are concerned mostly at this stage about the rhetoric. There's no reason to take the kinds of shots at Mexico and Mexicans in a broad way that simply doesn't reflect where Mexican society is. It reflects an American view of Mexico that it may not have even been accurate 35 or 40 years ago, but it's not accurate.
I was going to say the revolution.
But it's not accurate today.
No.
You know, Mexico is 50% and growing a middle-class society with the same values, the same desires, the same wants of middle-class families in the United States. And this is measured by any metric, by birth rates, by death rates, by education rates, by housing standards, by medical standards. So we those of us on the border who know this, actually are mostly concerned about name-calling of our friends that we know not to be the case. And frankly, I think the offense that Mexicans feel at this is entirely warranted. And I think over time will be moderated as the facts on the ground begin to be more commonly known among lead policymakers in Washington.
You know what's interesting about the rhetoric in Mexico? There is a rally around the flag effect in the sense that, you know, Mexicans from across almost all political spectrums, including López Obrador, said we need to support the president. There's this rally effect, but it's interesting how it's manifested itself in the case of Mexico, because historically Mexico would have come out and said something, we're anti-American imperialism and stuff like that, but it's not like that. It's not targeted against Americans. It's specifically targeted against the president. And I think that's an interesting evolution in the Mexican body politic, that they don't they've identified what they perceive to be the problem. And it's not all of the United States.
That's a very important point, but the danger is that if it
persists,
then in fact we will see a return to what I often point out was a proper relationship, but not a friendly or cooperative one.
Right.
So that when you go back before...
after World War II,
even before... I think it started to turn with Cedillo Clinton.
Yeah.
And I actually was honored to be part of that group with Angel Gurría and Janet Reno and Juan Rebolledo and Luis Herrera Lasso, Gustavo Moar, Doris Meisner. People who started to turn the relationship away from being proper but not really cooperative. And that existed because of the nationalism, understandable nationalism, and then trade protectionism following the Mexican Revolution. From 1910 on, after Porfirio Diaz, there was a very much a nationalist, self-contained view within Mexico. And that reflected necessarily a certain amount of anti-gringo attitudes, which was understandable because ever since the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, when half of Mexico, when half of Mexico was severed and became the southwestern and western United States, from starting with Texas in 1836 and then the treaty in 1848, virtually California up to the Oregon border, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, was all had been part of Mexico. And to add insult to injury, most Mexicans never forgot it, and most Americans never knew it. Mm-hmm. So that you had this tense, it was a tension. Now, the asymmetry was such that Mexico asserted it in the attitudes and foreign policy, the independence of, during the Castro years of Cuba, si, Yankee, no. But I want to emphasize that because the relationship since 2000 and since 1998, 2000.
It's the deal Fox and Calderon.
Completely, and Peña Nieto.
And Peña Nieto.
Is completely different, and the respect that there is mutually among officials of the governments makes this entirely different. We don't want to risk that, because in fact, going forward into the 21st century, the strength of the United States is actually dependent on North America, on Canada and Mexico. And I actually have my view is that the American century definitely is setting. There's no question about it. The unilateral or the unipolar situation after the fall of the Soviet Union, the dominance of the United States in terms of its economic position in the world, all of that is actually changing largely because the policies of the United States, as misguided as they may have been in some instances, but generally from the post-World War II period, it's the United States policies of the American century that have created the conditions for many countries to grow, right, for the world economy to grow, for trade to grow,
Bretton Woods,
for medical, for the middle class to grow from 3% of the world's population to almost 40%. But even though the American century, some people say, well, that means the Americas in decline, it's actually not the case. Because the American century may be setting, but it's doing so in the context of a North American century that's just beginning and that will be very competitive economically. This, and for me, it's not just Canada, Mexico, the United States, although look at the advantages, Sake. Half a billion people, $1 trillion in trade, trade-friendly borders.
$20 trillion economy. Right?
$20 trillion joint economy. Energy independence within reach. Three democracies, which, although all of them are imperfect, actually share the commitment to the rule of law. Mm-hmm. These are enormous assets. That's the strength that I see going forward in terms of being able to compete against East Asia, South Asia. And in fact, we need to teach our children, the todos somos norteamericanos. Mm-hmm. You know, ever since Jorge Castañeda said
the
whole wrote the book,
right?
Well, he did, but he wrote the Future of Mexico with a co-author, and he said, you know, la corazón se queda, me queda Latino, pero la cartera es puramente norteamericana.
For the non-Spanish speaking listeners, Alan just said, my heart's in Mexico, but my wallet's in North America.
My heart is very Latin, but my wallet is right, purely so North America.
So look a bit into your crystal ball. What do you think is going to happen to NAFTA over the next year?
I think as the facts on the ground, as the facts that we don't really trade so much together, even though we still call it international trade, what we do is make things together.
Yeah.
What we have is a shared production platform in which much of the cross-border traffic is actually part and parcel of a single production process.
Right.
That's why we've worked so hard to bring down the transaction costs and to segregate out lawful trade and travel. I think there will be discussions. I think there will be changes that will strengthen, in some respects, the relationships. But I am optimistic about North America, because you cannot look at it and not see it. And as I say, my view of North America is actually Colombia to the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
And that when you look at the competitive advantages, and you look at the North America being the key to resolving the problems in the Northern Triangle of Central America, and reincorporating the strength of Colombia with Mexico in North America. No, I think...
Do you see Colombia as a future...
Well, Colombia, remember, Colombia is the gateway to South America, but it's also, before the Panama Canal, was clearly part of Central America, the North America, part of the North American phenomenon.
Yeah.
It is the, as a result of the work of President Uribe and President Santos and others in the last 30 years, Colombia's back.
Yeah.
To where it was as a leading nation in our hemisphere, we should capitalize on the strengths of North America sake, and part of that is actually the perimeter security
that is
important. Más importante la línea, more important the perimeter.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think some of Mexico's negotiating chips could be in all of this? It's something that Mexican policymakers will really want to listen to. So, I mean,
there is no secret that the security relationships between the United States and Mexico are very critical. I would argue to the security of both countries, but
yeah.
Much of the security of the United States in terms of counterterrorism and organized transnational criminal organization depends on a close security relationship with Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
But let me give you the example of migration as a
that's
as
the one
example.
I wanted to get to.
You know, Mexico is in the midst as part of its transformation, and I would argue with the exception of the remarkable transformation of China, that Mexico's transformation over the last 40 years has been a remarkable phenomenon. But remember, Mexico, for most of the last 70 years, was a sending country, and it sent migrants to the United States. It's now a transit country and a receiving country to some extent, and as the economy grows, it will more and more be a receiving country. As a result of that, when Central Americans started moving toward the U.S. border, we developed, as we had in so many other areas of the security relationship, a joint management approach, a joint border management approach strategically to managing the flows of irregular migrants from, frankly, both from Central America and from Mexico. The work that has been done is actually quite extensive.
I heard a statistic that, I don't know if it's correct, but that out of 10 migrants, Mexico captures 5. I don't know if that's correct.
Those border metrics on apprehension has taken 25 years for the United States to get even close.
So don't pay too much attention to them.
Well, I think they give you a weather vane picture. But the fact of the matter is that Mexico has apprehended 400,000 Central American migrants in the last 2 years, every one of whom, or virtually every one of whom, intended to move to the U.S. border. So when you look at this and you say, what is the relationship, why does the relationship matter so much to the United States, that joint border management and migration, the co-management, the co-responsibilidad that we have for repatriating Mexican citizens to the United States. We work very closely
yes.
with Mexican immigration. Absent that cooperation, this becomes a far more difficult security situation for the United States. And it is with that light that I would look at Secretary Kelly's recent memoranda of 2 days ago now.
Yeah.
So people say, what is the impact on Mexico and how could you operate? Well, those many of the provisions in those memoranda require cooperation of the kind that we've developed with Mexico. You cannot remove non-Mexicans to Mexico to await proceedings if Mexico is not cooperating, if there are not conditions for the proper care and feeding. And I think what the challenge that exists for the U.S. and Mexican policymakers, Saki, in this joint approach to security, not seamlessly joint, but largely cooperative and strategically aligned, is to actually create a balance now that enforces the immigration laws of both countries in a way that takes into account humanitarian needs, but is not dominated by them, such that there is again a balanced deterrent to irregular migration. And that is something within the grasp of U.S. and Mexican policymakers, but only if they work together.
Okay, so I'll make this the last question, Alan, because I've spoken way too much. There's a little hump in the relationship now. Let's put it that way. Do you think we're going to get over it? Are you optimistic?
I do. Again, because the reality, you pointed out that the hostility of the Mexican people is not against the American people. Jorge Castaneda pointed out something else that I should bring up. He said, mm-hmm. It's very interesting. Traditionally, in our relationship, it's the Mexican intellectual and opinion leader who has been very resistant to cooperation with the United States for all the reasons that I went through earlier in our discussion. But the Mexican people have not ever had a problem of understanding. In fact, 10 million, 10% of the people born in Mexico in the last generation are in the United States. Yeah. There are 1 million U.S. that are living in Mexico. So the Mexican people have understood this. It was the intellectuals who resisted, and they've actually come a long way now toward accepting the importance of North America. The exact opposite.
It was good business for these intellectuals to, go on TV and right. pick on the U.S.
Yes, yes. But, listen.
30, 40 years ago.
But look at in light of what's happened, no American should be heard complaining about that right now.
Yeah.
But the situation in the United States is exactly the opposite. The intellectuals and the opinion leaders have been promoting closer ties with Mexico because we typically, those leaders have recognized that this is not just, as Alan Riding said, distant neighbors in the 80s. We're not neighbors because we can't move from one another.
Right.
We are partners by definition and by geographic requirement. Most of the intellectuals have accepted that as important, unlike the situation in Mexico. It's the American people who have never really grasped it and taken the and so, look, I think the destiny of North America is clear. I think that President Trump, being a man who may not like what he hears, after a while he does hear it, and he does react to it. And he's a smart man, and he is a businessman. And the nature of the shared production platforms and the integration of the U.S. and Mexican economies, the extent to which American farmers sell to Mexico, the extent to which American manufacturers produce parts that are assembled in Mexico and vice versa, all of this will not escape notice. And that will actually lead to a moderation in the rhetoric. And I believe it's an opportunity to improve NAFTA and TLC. Look, the fact of the matter is that how could this remarkable relationship in 20 years, 22 years, increase our trade from $80 billion a year to just under $700 billion a year, $1 million a minute, and yet when it needed to be defended, there was no one there to defend it. That's something that we actually have to address together. And I think we're going to have an opportunity to address the labor concerns, to address the adaptation concerns, look, to address the environmental concerns. Look, the fact of the matter is that some of the jobs that were lost in America were due to this trade deal.
Yes.
Although I hasten to point out that
most of it was automation. Yeah.
Most of it was automation. In fact, the only research that I've seen from the University of California at San Diego suggests that after the 2008 recession, more jobs would have been lost in the United States. But the fact is, whether it's automation or whether it is trade with China, The fact of the matter is that there were not sufficient safety nets put under American communities. There were not sufficient retraining at the community colleges of America to permit people to adapt to the changes, to make the transition in their own lives. And that has wreaked wreaked havoc in American society, and is reflected, I believe, in the last election. Having said that, we have an opportunity to address some of those issues. We need to address them, but we need to do it in the context of North America, and that's going to require that we actually that we start looking at things differently, so that in fact, when there are investments, huge investments in Mexico, as there will be, that in fact the impact of those investments in Canada and the United States are taken into account, and the same thing vice versa. When Mexican companies move the bulk of their operations to the United States, which several are doing, in fact, that will require adjustments here in Mexico. But listen, this is the stuff of history, Saki. But I believe that we need the people of the United States to understand the importance of Mexico. We need the intellectuals and opinion leaders of Mexico to resist the cry of some from the left to pull populism back into Mexican politics with an anti-American bent. And we need to get down to the business of North America, energy independence, trade adjustments, but trade. And I'll go even further out on the limb. I think that when the facts on the ground become apparent, and we improve NAFTA, and TLC. That will be the move toward looking at the Asia-Pacific region and its relationship with North America with different lenses and a different eye.
Your argument about what's going to happen in North America or the U.S.-Mexico overlaps, I guess, my argument that the institutions are there, the interests are there, sort of like let's just relax a little bit and wait and don't overreact. I think the Mexican listeners to the podcast are going to be very happy to hear that there's somebody else other than me saying to calm down, take things, you know, do things, think before you act, and that'll be better for all three countries. And
that doesn't mean that basic interests and basic sensitivity shouldn't be asserted.
No.
But it means that one of the things we do as partners, Saki, is that we recognize that there are flights in politics.
Yes.
And that we shouldn't let those flights of politics derail us from the basic trajectory of U.S.-Mexican history, which is far more positive today than it was at any other point in our bilateral history.
Yeah. Being a Canadian, we kind of do things in a very subtle kind of way, you know, when the White House made these statements, they were over the top. But I think also Mexico's reaction could have been a bit more, just ignore this for now, which is basically what the Canadians did. I know you actually side with the Mexicans on this, and you say that, you know, they attacked
Saki, Canadians were not name called. Mexicans were not Canadians.
No, you're right.
Canadians were not put at the center of a political campaign. And that, you know, listen, my Mexican colleagues and friends know that as much as I am a fan of Mexico and a fan of my own patriot, my own country, I'm not hesitant to express the kinds of criticisms that have to be taken both in to improve democracy in our country, in the United States, but also in Mexico.
Yeah.
And you know, I even occasionally say to a Canadian, We let you win a hockey game from time to time, but you know, that doesn't mean that you should not think that we're not competitive with you as well.
Okay, Alan, thank you.
Thanks.
Very, very much
Thanks, Saki, for the
talk. You're going to give a class now in the Diplomado on national security, and I think the students are going to be very happy to hear what you have to say. Because some of the things that I said last time, they were angry at me because I said, I made the subtle, let's be quiet, you know, let's just calm down and think things over, and you're kind of saying, well, you know what, maybe not so much, you know?
Yeah, and Mark Twain had a terrific bit of advice, which was, first let's get the facts, then you can distort them as much as you'd like.
Thank you very much, Alan. So, off to class.
Good.
Thank you very much again.